Welcome to STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM Talk.
Welcome to STEM Talk, where we introduce you to fascinating people who passionately inhabit the scientific and technical frontiers of our society. Hi, I'm your host, Don Kernegas, and joining me to introduce today's podcast is the man behind the curtain, Dr. Ken Ford, IHMC's director and chairman of the Double Secret Selection Committee that selects all the guests who appear on STEM Talk.
Hi, Don. Great to be here.
So back in February, Ken and I hosted our very first Ask Me Anything episode. And we had a lot of fun answering listeners' questions. And since that episode, number 83, just in case you might have missed it, we've had a steady stream of new questions and inquiries coming our way.
Some of them are real toughies, too. As Dawn said, the questions are sort of come in constantly, and we sort of save them and curate them for the next Ask Me Anything episode. And we promised last time not to wait 3 years before we do it again. So we'll do another one in a few months, perhaps.
So it's pretty exciting to think that as we moved into the second half of the year and start the countdown to 2020, which is insane. Sorry, I'm wrapping my head around that. That STEM Talk is getting ready to reach its milestone of 100 episodes.
That's even more insane.
Yeah, it is. So, Ken, do you have any insights into who the Double Secret Selection Committee might invite to appear on episode number 100?
Well, Don, it's called the Double Secret Selection Committee for a good reason. The committee meets only in skiffs and is very secret. You, as well as our listeners, will just have to stay tuned.
Well, I'm excited, and I'm sure it will be somebody good. And as always, we have some housekeeping to take care of before Ken and I start answering questions. First, let me say we really appreciate all of you who have subscribed to STEM Talk and those of you who have written all the wonderful 5-star reviews. The Double Secret Selection Committee continues to carefully review iTunes, Google, Stitcher, Overview, and other podcast apps for the wittiest and most lavishly praise-filled reviews to read on STEM Talk. If you hear your review read on STEM Talk, just contact us at stemtalk@ihmc.us to claim your official STEM Talk t-shirt.
Today, our winning review was posted by someone who goes by the name Lee Lang. It's appropriately titled Topic Request and reads, "Thank you, STEM Talk, for filling my science cup. As I teach children to love science and math, I too need continued insight into the science world around me. So thank you. I also have a question. Could you do an episode related to neurodevelopment disorders and also one on research and concerns related to vaccines?"
Well, thank you, Lee Lang, and thank you to all of our other listeners who helped STEM Talk become such a great success. So, Ken, since we're going to be answering listeners' questions today, maybe we should start with Lee Lang's question.
Indeed. Well, Lee Lang, we noticed your review a little while back and had Dr. David Geary, a cognitive developmental scientist from the University of Missouri, on our guest on episode 83. David has spent more than 3 decades studying children's cognitive development, especially why some children struggle with mathematical cognition, among other things. It was a fascinating interview that covered not only David's research on child development and education, but also his research that has looked at evolutionary psychology and perhaps why the human brain is shrinking. In terms of vaccines, we will look into that. It's certainly a controversial and emotional topic these days, where there's more heat than light.
STEM Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM Talk.
Hi, welcome to STEM Talk. I'm your host, Don Kernegas, and joining me is Ken Ford.
Hello, Don.
So today we are responding to listener questions. And just as a note, there are a couple of questions that were sent to us that we would have loved to answer because they are fantastic questions. They were outside of our areas of individual expertise, so we are not answering those in this specific podcast.
That's probably a good thing.
So our first question today is for Ken. A listener writes, "I listened to the Walter Longo interview, which is episode 64, and he seemed to make a compelling case that eating more than 100 grams of protein a day accelerates aging by increasing IGF-1 and mTOR signaling. But then I listened to Stuart Phillips, which is episode 82, and he said that the recommended daily allowance for protein is too low. So I went online, and now I'm more confused than ever. So Ken, what is your take on protein?"
Okay, this will take a little while, but first let me say that I am with Stu Phillips on this one, and Walter Longo and several other experts in the longevity field strongly believe that dietary protein should be drastically limited with the goal of enhancing, extending lifespan. And as the question mentioned, part of this is protein activates mTOR signaling and IGF-1 signaling. And these have both been shown to shorten lifespan in a range of animal models. Of course, if you never activate mTOR and have very low levels of IGF-1, you may live a long time, but you won't like it. So mTOR activation is necessary for maintenance and growth of muscle. IGF-1, as everyone knows, plays a very important anabolic role as well as a health role. So for example, IGF-1, the current science is that the risk looks sort of like a bathtub curve with very high risk, bad outcomes for those on the far left side with extremely low IGF-1 and bad outcomes for those with super elevated IGF-1 and sort of a Goldilocks level in the middle. With respect to mTOR signaling, the current best science would lead me to have the opinion that pulsatile mTOR signaling is a good thing. Perhaps constantly elevated mTOR isn't, but pulsatile elevation of mTOR caused by exercise, for example, and by having a good meal, I count that as a good thing. Now back to Valtralongo's paper. The paper that generated the most discussion from his group reported that those in their study aged 50 to 65 years old had a 75% increase in overall mortality and a fourfold increase in cancer and diabetes during an 18-year follow-up. Interestingly, though, respondents over the age of 65, high protein intake was associated with reduced cancer and improved overall mortality. Now, while I agree that older people need more protein for maintenance of skeletal muscle, it seems ridiculous to think that at exactly 65 years old, the associations suddenly flip over. This is clearly an artifact of a tortured statistical analysis. Additionally, the risk ratios they talk about are calculated as relative risk and not absolute risk, which, as we have discussed on previous episodes, can be very deceiving. The University of Southern California press release announcing the finding rather astoundingly quoted Valtralongo as saying, "We provide convincing evidence that a high protein diet, particularly if the protein are derived from animals, is nearly as bad as smoking for your health." This quote, of course, went viral, as the media loves provocative quotes like this. And, we're sort of used to the media generating headlines of this kind, but it seems to me to be unseemly for a scientist to do so. Besides, it is factually incorrect. In response to the paper, as you can imagine, nobody changed their mind. It just pleased or annoyed people, depending on which side of the argument they fall. A number of luminaries, I think it was 9 research experts on protein, crafted a excellent letter to the editor titled "The Contrived Association of Dietary Protein with Mortality." Very nice letter. When it came out, I read it. But guess what? The editor refused to publish it. So little wonder the public is often confused given the state of nutrition science. And now a question for Don. You have mentioned current research that you are doing at IHMC on exogenous ketones. Can you expand a bit on some of the studies that you're conducting there these days?
Yeah, absolutely. So as noted, they are on exogenous ketones. We are not doing anything specific to the ketogenic diet, at least as of yet. But it's been fantastic working on studies looking at exogenous ketones, particularly ketone esters, because we feel like right now they seem to have the biggest bang for the buck with respect to dosing. And there's a lot of interest within the military looking at ketone esters for potential applications in acute settings. So specifically, because of our expertise in extreme environments, we're looking at the effect of exogenous ketones on mitigating symptoms of hypoxia, for example, so breathing low levels of oxygen and the deficits that you see with that, and also deficits that are associated with divers that are in cold water for an extended period of time. So those are two of the big projects that we're working on. We have a number of different settings where we're looking at hypoxia and cold water, but we're really excited to see how these studies turn out with respect to the effect of exogenous ketones. So a question back for Ken. So please ask him if he has seen the 2017 paper titled "Is Sociopolitical Egalitarianism Related to Bodily and Facial Formidability in Men?" and what are his thoughts on this?
Oh, boy. I usually go to great lengths to avoid reading papers with titles that read anything like that. However, I could not escape this paper. Several people emailed it to me, and I decided to read it. So the takeaway is stronger men are not socialists. Duh. Imagine my surprise. This study was conducted at Brunel University in London. They assessed 171 men, looking at their height, weight, overall physical strength, and bicep circumference, along with their views on the redistribution of wealth and income inequality. The study published in the Evolution in Human Behavior journal found that weaker men were more likely to favor socialist policies than stronger men. In women, there was no correlation found. Now, this is not the first time this association has been observed. I heard a very similar result years ago. In 2013, another group did a study that closely aligned with the results reported from the Brunel group. This was a group in Denmark, and they studied hundreds of men from America, Denmark, and Brazil using the same criteria that Brunel subsequently used, and found that men's opinions on the redistribution of wealth could be predicted by their upper body strength, with powerful men more likely to take a conservative stance. Both sets of researchers explained their results from an evolutionary perspective. As one researcher put it, our minds evolved in environments where strength was a big determinant of success.
Fantastic. I thought that was a very good response to a question specific to a paper with that title, which still just cracks me up. So a listener asked whether Ken has any thoughts on the utility of a paper out of Harvard, which appeared this February in JAMA Network Open, describing an observational epidemiology study which found a strong association between one's ability to do push-ups and future cardiovascular events.
Yes, I do have some views on this paper, and taken together with the previous paper, one can imagine all kinds of interesting outcomes. This is another paper that I would say falls into, really, you had to do research to know this. Okay. So, both the paper itself and the media response to the paper have amazed me. When I first heard about it, I actually wondered if it was a prank. You know, people submit these prank papers to journals, and they sometimes make it through peer review, and I thought this might be one of those. USA Today reported the results like this. Those who could do more than 40 push-ups in a timed test at preliminary examination were 96% less likely to have developed a cardiovascular problem compared to those who could do no more than 10 push-ups. Let's unpack this. The group under study were 1,104 firefighters who were tested at baseline for their ability to do push-ups and then followed for cardiovascular disease over the next 10 years. The paper reports a very strong association between push-up prowess and the risk for cardiovascular disease. But what it really shows us is that strong younger men are less likely to have heart disease over the next 10 years than obese, weaker, old men. Shocking news, I tell you, shocking. The over 40 push-up group's mean age was 35 years old, with a mean BMI of 26.8. There's not a lot of heart disease expected to be found in lean, strong 35-year-olds. The less than 10 push-ups group mean age was 48 years old, sporting a mean BMI of 33.1, which is normally characterized as moderately obese. While this paper and its findings seem beyond obvious, as the authors note, push-ups are a functional and low-cost test that may not run afoul of the Americans with Disabilities Act, as has happened with the use of age and BMI in occupational settings as determinants of fitness for duty. That said, it seems hard to imagine that Harvard had to study this to come to this conclusion. And when you listen to the media and just breeze through the paper, you get this correlation with push-ups and cardiovascular disease, an inverse correlation. But what really is driving this is essentially age and obesity, and none of that should be surprising.
A listener writes, I have read one of Dr. Ford's papers with Pat Hayes, in which he strongly criticizes the Turing test, and yet he let Dr. Epstein off the hook when that topic came up in the recent interview. So please ask him about that and if his views have changed since the paper was published nearly 20 years ago.
Well, first, no, on this topic, my views have not changed. But there is kind of a three-part answer, I'd say, to this listener's question. First, STEM Talk is aimed at having interesting guests discuss their work in depth. And it's not necessary that I agree with them on every issue. Also, I really wanted to focus on Dr. Epstein's current work, which is focused on privacy and search manipulation in the context of several large technology companies, which I think is much more important than the Turing test that nobody takes seriously these days, at least not AI practitioners. And finally, we've already discussed the Turing test at some length in other episodes of STEM Talk. So I appreciate the question, but that's why I let Robert off the hook.
So another listener reached out to us with a question for Ken. On a recent STEM Talk AMA podcast, Ken Ford mentions that canola oil is not a healthy oil. This is a very important concept since it is widely used. So can Dr. Ford elaborate on this, please? I can't find much on PubMed that supports his concern. Thank you.
Well, this is certainly a good question, and it's a topic where reasonable people could easily disagree. The FDA has for decades had canola oil on its list of products generally regarded as safe, but opponents talk of many hazards, real and, I'm afraid, imagined. As is often the case in disputes such as this, truth probably lies somewhere in the middle, and the scientific literature here is mixed. In comparison with the other most common industrial seed oils, especially soybean and corn oil, canola oil seems positively benign. For example, canola oil can boast of an excellent omega-6 to omega-3 ratio. However, one aspect of canola oil that I find particularly unappealing is that it is extracted from hybrid cultivars of rapeseed and subject to very intensive industrial processing involving high temperatures, degumming, bleaching, and deodorizing. I see no point in consuming any food which requires degumming, bleaching, and deodorizing.
Yum.
Yum. The research on the safety of canola oil is mixed, but several of the papers reporting a potential hazard are worth considering, at least, especially when there are so many other good options for food oils. For example, a 2017 paper appearing in the journal Scientific Reports concluded that our findings do not support a beneficial effect of chronic canola oil consumption on two important aspects of Alzheimer's disease pathology, which includes memory impairments as well as synaptic integrity. While more studies are needed, our data do not justify the current trend aimed at replacing olive oil with canola oil. And that's all a quote from the lead author in the study. The researchers also noted that the mice fed canola oil gained more weight than the group fed the normal mouse diet. As this was a mouse study, we do not know if these outcomes will translate to humans, so I would characterize these results as concerning, but not yet conclusive. Dr. Pratico, the corresponding author in this paper, was quoted in a press release as saying, "We need to be careful before we say that it is healthy. Based on the evidence from this study, canola oil should not be thought of as being equivalent to oils with proven health benefits." It is probably the case that canola oil is safe, used in moderation. Whenever we eat processed food or eat at a restaurant, it is a very good chance that your food will contain canola oil. If one is planning to buy canola oil for consumption at home, which I am not suggesting, perhaps the best idea is to look for one that's marked as organic and expeller pressed. This will cost a little more, but it's probably a better product.
So Ken, if not canola oil, what oils do you favor?
Well, first, I would suggest olive oil, which has many well-documented health benefits. Of course, it is important to be confident in your source for olive oil, as much olive oil contains all kinds of things, including canola oil. I get my olive oil sent directly to me from the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. They provide some of the freshest olive oil from top producers around the world. We will put a link in the show notes to the club. In addition to olive oil, I like avocado oil, which has a remarkably high smoke point, making it a good choice for cooking. Also, macadamia oil, coconut oil, and ghee are all really good choices.
Okay, Ken, so question from another listener. I saw where Ken was appointed to the National Security Commission on Artificial Intelligence. I'm sure you've had a few meetings by now. Can you talk about the commission and the main issues that you all are investigating?
Sure. The commission is broadly looking at AI from the perspective of national security, hence the title, and our examination includes national competitiveness issues as well as military aspects. The commission will also include ethical considerations of the applications of AI. We are only in the early stages of our work, and we have thus far been focused on assessment and fact-finding, but it will be an interesting commission for sure.
Okay, so we have another question for you, Ken.
Oh, too many questions for Ken.
So a listener writes, there's so many so-called futurists foreshadowing a dark future where artificial intelligence has a doom and gloom effect on humanity at large. And we know in past episodes of STEM Talk, you've alluded to your vision of a brighter and more hopeful future. So can you expand upon that by painting a future where AI and intelligence systems are helping in ways that, you know, the doom and gloom futurists can't seem to think about?
Well, sure. It's important to recognize that AI is already a ubiquitous technology embedded in all kinds of devices and systems that are all around us every day. Technology developed in AI research labs is found in every router, found in all modern automobiles, all smartphones, search engines, and everywhere else. So it's important to understand that AI is not a standalone technology, but it's something you embed in everything else to make it work better. However, when hands are wringing, they are often wrung over imagined dystopian futures, as the question implies, in which AI sort of runs amok and takes over our planet. This is remarkably unlikely. It's important to appreciate, however, that technology is neutral and does not convey any inherent moral component. One can imagine a near endless list of possible applications of AI, and these can and will be used for good or ill. It's entirely up to us. So whether we as a species apply our technology with sufficient thought and wisdom is very much in question. But there's nothing special about AI requiring particular attention in this case.
So, Ken, as many of our listeners know, you were a senior executive at NASA in the late 90s and more recently served as a chairman of the NASA Advisory Council. So I'm going to send this question to you. In 2013, the European Space Agency launched the ambitious Gaia mission to catalog the composition, the brightness, positions, directions, and velocities of billions of stars in the Milky Way. The immense amount of data that ESA has released to the scientific community is slowly being processed. What can you tell us about this ongoing mission and its preliminary results?
Wow, I'm continuing to be impressed with our listeners. Gaia is a European space observatory whose goal is to chart a three-dimensional map of the Milky Way in order to reveal the composition, formation, and evolution of our galaxy. An audacious and interesting undertaking. Gaia is located at a Lagrange point, and we've mentioned those earlier in the earlier episode of STEM Talk. Lagrange points are gravitationally stable areas, in this case in the Sun-Earth system, and the particular Lagrange point where it's located is called L2, and L2 is located about 930,000 miles from Earth in the opposite direction from the Sun. So spacecraft at this location can use a real minimum of fuel to maintain their location in space, and this is due to the aforementioned gravitational nature of the spot, where gravitational fields are essentially nulled out and it's quite stable. And for this particular mission, L2 is a particularly good location because it's far enough from Earth that the light emanating from and the size of our planet will not interfere with observations. Last April, ESA released a second data set that included the positions for approximately 1.7 billion stars, as well as a measure of their overall brightness at various optical wavelengths. Finally, Gaia results in the form of complete data sets are not expected to be available till sometime in the early 2020s. But this is an interesting mission, and it helps one consider and reflect on the size of the universe. We're talking just about our little galaxy here, and they're up to 1.7 billion stars, each of which perhaps having a system around them of planets. Mind-boggling.
That's absolutely incredible. So we're going to keep on the space theme for a second here. A paper published in late 2018 in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences was titled "Space Radiation Triggers Persistent Stress Response, Increases Senescence Signaling, and Decreases Cell Migration in Mouse Intestine." And it suggests that deep space radiation could pose a significant danger to the gastrointestinal tract of astronauts. So do you know if NASA is studying this phenomenon more in depth, and are there any ideas on how we're going to mitigate this?
So that is an interesting paper you mentioned, and the paper describes the results of experiments using animal models to try to understand the possible effects of galactic cosmic radiation exposure on astronauts, and they did this work at the NASA facility at Brookhaven. This research points to one of the many risks to the health of astronauts during long-duration deep space missions, such as a human mission to Mars. Shorter trips, such as a trip to the moon, would involve much less exposure and would likely reduce the risk of negative outcomes. This study suggests that exposure to galactic cosmic radiation could significantly damage gastrointestinal tissue, leading to long-term, perhaps permanent, functional alterations. The study also raises concern about a high risk of tumor development in the stomach and colon. This is only the latest bad news regarding galactic cosmic radiation. Earlier work has looked at impairment to brain tissue, reduced cognition, and general accelerated aging. Of course, here on Earth, we are protected by our magnetosphere, and astronauts on the International Space Station are also protected by the magnetosphere. However, for people outside the protection of Earth's magnetosphere, space radiation is a serious hazard. For example, even assuming the fastest transit option, the galactic cosmic radiation exposure on a round trip to Mars would be roughly equivalent to receiving a whole body CT scan every 5 or 6 days. And unfortunately, unlike Earth, Mars has no magnetosphere for protection once safely on the surface. Our current approaches to radiation shielding may not be sufficient to protect astronauts on long-duration mission in deep space, but this remains an area of further development. Also, there is active research focused on the development of biological countermeasures intended to make the astronauts themselves more resilient to the effects of radiation. In fact, we hosted just such a meeting for NASA on this exact topic only a few years back. As we have seen over the years, human spaceflight is inherently dangerous and includes many risks, some more substantial than this one. For example, just safely landing a human exploration-size lander on the Martian surface remains a substantial technological challenge. Each of the many difficulties associated with human spaceflight should be seen as challenges to overcome, and in some cases, risks to thoughtfully accept, rather than reasons not to go.
STEM Talk is an educational service of the Florida Institute for Human and Machine Cognition, a not-for-profit research lab pioneering groundbreaking technologies aimed at leveraging and extending human cognition, perception, locomotion, and resilience.
A listener writes, "Dawn, I've read somewhere that you were involved in a record-breaking freshwater cave dive. Can you elaborate on this experience?"
Yeah, absolutely. So Ken likes to talk about reinvention of self, and I have to say this is a previous career before I got into research, and even though it did involve a little bit of research in its own right. So I started cave diving when I was 15 years old. I started working on a number of different projects and got involved in this project called the Woodville Karst Plain Project that's been a continuous project. It's actually still ongoing today. since the early 90s. And so I joined in 1996 and eventually became operations manager and was also a diver with the team. And over the course of over a decade of working with the team, we set a number of world records for depth and time in a cave. Specifically, there is a massive dive that we did. It was actually the last one that I was involved in before I kind of retired from the cave diving realm. And that was a 300-foot dive for almost 7 hours, bottom time, about 20 hours of decompression, and it was a 7-mile underwater cave dive at that depth.
Wow.
And actually went into one cave system, came out another entrance 7 miles away. It's absolutely incredible to see the teamwork that was involved in all that. We had over 50 team members. One of the cool things, though, working on that project, we were involved in a number of hydrological studies, biological studies when it came to the underwater cave environment. We had our hands on a lot of different projects that were associated with local universities and other universities that would come and tag in to study these absolutely incredible underwater cave systems located in the panhandle of Florida and all the way through north central Florida. And just there's nothing else like them in the world. They're absolutely incredible. But the other cool thing is that there's a lot of technology and protocol and things like decompression procedures that evolved from that kind of diving because no one else is really doing that kind of diving at the time. So using different gases because of the depths we were diving and then using more different gases for the decompression part to try to minimize development of decompression sickness. And there's a lot that we learned over the course of that time, but that also led to my interest in becoming a researcher. And that's why I actually ended up getting into research in the first place is because of questions that popped up from those experiences as a diver with that project.
That had to be an amazing experience.
Yeah, absolutely incredible.
Continuing on the diving theme, we have another question for Dawn. Are there biological or genetic factors that influence individual susceptibility to decompression sickness or the bends?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that actually was part of my graduate studies when I did transition from being a person working in the diving field full-time into research. And just a little backup for the listeners that don't know what decompression sickness or the bends is. It's when your body is reacting to bubbles in the blood or tissues of your body, and those bubbles can be created because you're breathing inert gas at depth, and as you're coming up from depth, the inert gas pressure in your blood and tissues can potentially become greater than that. The pressure of that inert gas can become greater than the surrounding pressure. And then you reach a point of what's called supersaturation, and bubbles can form when you have supersaturation. So think of a Coke bottle that you open up too fast and all the bubbles that come out of solution. That can potentially happen in your body. You can potentially develop those bubbles, and then your body can respond to those bubbles, and then you can potentially develop decompression sickness. Now, just because you have those bubbles doesn't mean that you have the symptoms. So there's a big gap there that we're still trying to understand. But with respect to individual susceptibility, so time and depth are the most important things. But let's say we have two people who've done the exact same dives over the course of a day or a week, and now we're looking at one person might be more or less at risk. So things like age, fitness, hydration status, those things we're still trying to understand how they influence. We think they might influence susceptibility to decompression sickness, but there's still a lot of questions there. And then genetics, which is one of the questions I asked for some of my thesis work, is there a gene that yields susceptibility to developing decompression sickness or having this over-exacerbated response to those bubbles being present? We never found a solid answer on that. There's still a lot of work to be done. And a big piece of that is when you're doing genetic studies, you have to have large numbers. And decompression sickness is luckily relatively rare in the diving community. So it's something that the community definitely wants to continue to study moving forward.
Perhaps try the push-up test.
Yeah. Maybe that's the next one.
Yeah. So, Dawn, in 2015, Gina Shaw published a paper with the title, "New Study Suggests Brain is Connected to the Lymphatic System. What the Discovery Could Mean for Neurology." What have we learned since that landmark paper's publication? What technologies are we using now to delve into that particular research area? And what effect are those answers having in neurology? Are there, for example, implications for human spaceflight?
Yeah, so that's an incredibly exciting example, and our listeners may have heard me talk about the brain lymphatic system over previous podcasts with some of our guests. There's a lot that's been learned over the course of time. We're learning that brain lymphatic system, there are a number of different components to it. It seems to operate at peak when we're sleeping. So the idea is that the brain lymphatic system actually kind of flushes out the waste or the metabolic waste from the day when you're sleeping. So think about when you don't get enough sleep. We think that might be why you have that foggy headedness. And then think about people who don't get sleep chronically, so who don't get enough sleep over a long period of time. And there have been studies that have shown relationships between sleep deprivation or chronic sleep deprivation and development of certain neurodegenerative diseases. So there's the thought that there could be a link there between not flushing out that metabolic waste and eventual development of these neurodegenerative disease processes. So that's one thing that's been shown in animals, and we're starting to learn more in humans as well. As far as technologies go, it's been pretty interesting to figure out how are we going to look at the lymphatics in the brain. MRI is one of the hot tools right now. There have actually been a couple of studies published recently. There's one by Per Ida, who's over in Norway, who has been looking at MRI technologies for assessing brain lymphatic function in humans. And then we're working with individuals out of Caltech University who have developed a photoacoustic imaging device. And so this is essentially looks like an ultrasound, but it just has a little bit of different way in that it works. And it allows us to non-invasively image the peripheral lymphatics and even the deep cervical lymphatics. So the thought is that that connection of the peripheral lymphatics to the brain lymphatics happens to the deep cervical lymphatics. So if you can look at what's happening in the deep cervical lymphatics, you'll have an idea of what's happening in the brain. And so we're working with them to do studies, to do the human studies, and also to do those studies in a setting of simulated microgravity. So this is actually a NASA TRISH-funded study for both Caltech and our team. And so with that, why is NASA interested in this? And there are implications for human spaceflight. And the thought is that one of the hypotheses for the development of space-associated neuroocular syndrome, otherwise known as SANS, is that backup of fluid because of microgravity-induced headward fluid shifts can lead to the backup of brain lymphatics. So essentially, you're not flushing things out efficiently when you're in a microgravity setting. And so we are hoping this technology, one, we can start answering questions on land for ground-based simulations of microgravity, but then eventually if we could get that technology up into space to look at astronauts, that would be even better so we can start to get a better understanding to see if it is indeed the brain lymphatics that are associated with this development of SANS.
Wow, that's super interesting research. Just here on Earth, does sleeping position have any effect on the ability to flush? Is there any literature on that?
Yes, it does. On your side, actually, seem to have a better flushing.
The king of flush.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Have a better flushing from what they've seen so far. So
side sleeping has a merit there. It often gets criticized.
It does, yeah. And so it's really interesting. It'll be really fascinating to see as the technology starts to pick up for us to be able to image the brain lymphatics, because all of that is very, very new. Obviously, even just the concept of brain lymphatics is new. But as we start to get better technology, it's really exciting to see what we can learn about implications of, you know, reduced brain lymphatic function, or what can reduce brain lymphatic function, also what can improve it. So for individuals who may have a reduction.
A listener asked Dawn about a 2019 paper published in the Proceedings of the National Academies of Sciences titled Brain Ventricular Volume Changes Induced by Long-Duration Spaceflight. In short, the authors reported that brain ventricle size increased dramatically after spaceflight. Can you elaborate on this study and its implications for long-term spaceflight missions with humans?
So, yeah, Ken, this study stirred up a lot of interest and kind of goes back to what I was talking about with respect to the spaceflight-associated neuroocular syndrome and thinking that there could be an association of these neuroocular symptoms with backup of things like cerebral spinal fluid or potentially this brain lymphatic fluid. So this study in particular has piqued a lot of interest, and really, long story short, it's essentially just denoted that there is an absolute need for monitoring these astronauts when they come back from home and also further out after their missions are complete. Right now, the discussion point that I've heard is that we need to have a bigger N and have more astronauts assessed both pre and post flight for assessing if these ventricular volume changes are indeed something to be concerned about.
That makes sense.
So, Ken, we were recently treated to the first ever photograph of a black hole. A listener asks, can you explain the science behind imaging something like a black hole?
Absolutely. And indeed, it was an incredible image. NASA recently unveiled the first ever image taken, as Don said, of a black hole. However, I would hesitate to call it a photograph in the normal sense of that word. The image depicts a black hole at the center of our galaxy, which is roughly 55 million light years away. Further complicating the task of imaging this thing is the fact that the black hole is surrounded by an optically thick cloud of gas. So it can only be imaged via specific narrow wavelengths of light capable of piercing that cloud. Given the black hole's distance and the wavelength of light needed, taking an image of it with a single telescope would require one that is approximately the same diameter as the Earth. So that's a non-starter. Instead, the NASA team of scientists and engineers created what really can be best understood as a virtual telescope of that same size by linking together 8 radio observatories at 6 locations spread across the globe using the precise timing of atomic clocks. So, the resulting image was not a photograph taken in the visual spectrum. Key to the construction of that image was lots and lots of sophisticated data processing.
So continuing on the space theme, we have another question for Ken, which was posed on Facebook. So this is actually sent to me through Facebook. When it comes to the future of space exploration, where do you see the role of human and machine teaming?
Well, first, I should note that my views on human and machine teaming are very much in accord with those we discussed in some depth with Matt Johnson in episode 86 of STEM Talk. Humans are quintessentially explorers and makers of things. These traits, which really identify us as a species and account for our survival, are reflected with particular clarity in the mission and methods of space exploration. NASA's missions to distant worlds like Mars are conducted by 2 groups working together as a team. Humans and the machines that they design, launch, and operate. These are computational machines that carry our curiosity and intelligence with them as they extend the human exploration of the universe. All exploration is human exploration. One hears of a debate between human exploration and robotic space exploration. That's nonsense. All exploration is done by humans. The rovers did not build themselves and decide to travel to space because they are curious. No, we are curious, and therefore we are the explorers. A listener writes, I read that Dawn is involved in the NASA NESA 60-day bed rest study. Can she expand on what that study actually involves? It sounds horrible to be 60 days in bed rest.
It involves participants who have an incredible amount of patience and dedication to space science, is all I can say.
And don't value their health. I hope they're well paid.
They are well paid. So, and incredibly, we're all super proud of them. So this is a study that's taking place, and it's being supported by both NASA and the European Space Agency. It's 60 days of head down tilt bed rest. So essentially, individuals are laying in a bed at -6 degrees tilt. Now, once they lay down in that bed, they don't come up for 60 days. So everything you do, from going to the bathroom to eating to showering to everything you do, you are in that negative tilt. So actually, it's pretty cool because the participants, they've recommended when they come in, they had an incredible screen process. They said, I think they had over 8,000 applicants for these positions, which is incredible in itself. But they did a pretty thorough screening as far as health and also psych, and got a pretty good representation across males and females for the participants. They actually recommended that they find something during those 60 days to do, that's an end goal. So like learn a new language or take a course, which I think is fantastic. I could see if I were writing my dissertation where maybe that would be of interest, but I still don't think you could get me to lay in bed for 60 days at -6 degrees. So there are actually over 100 research team members involved in this project, which is absolutely incredible in itself. And they're from all around the world. And it's being conducted at the ENVI Hab at the German Space Agency's DLR facilities over in Cologne, Germany. And specifically, our group is involved in looking at neurological responses to the 60-day head-down tilt. And also, half of the participants are going to be getting intermittent doses of gravity by centrifuge over the course of those 60 days. And so they're going to look to see if there is a positive effect in reversing some of those symptoms and some of those changes that you see with simulated microgravity. And just as an aside, head down tilt bed rest has been shown to be a very strong analog for simulating microgravity. So again, our group is looking at neurological effects, and specifically within our subgroup, we are looking at changes in eye movement. And we think the eyes are the windows to the brain, and as you have these subtle changes that happen in the brain, you can capture those changes by looking at subtle changes in eye movement. So we're going to be doing eye tracking in individuals before, during, and after these exposures. We're really excited about seeing the results, and there's going to be a lot of data coming out of these studies.
Really interesting.
So a listener asked us to please ask Ken what he regards as some of the biggest problems in science? That's a pretty heavy question.
Yeah, this was not a gift from the listener. I wish I could point to, when you say hard problems or biggest problems, I wish I could point to an open, hard scientific or technological challenge as the biggest problem. And there are many such technical and scientific challenges that remain completely open and need study. But today, in my view, the biggest difficulty facing science writ large is a lack of replication and quality in the research and a substantial dose of politics, which is unwelcome in science. So starting with replication, we now see many, and sometimes actually most, published results in many disciplines cannot be replicated. And this is a significant problem. As just one example, a 2015 Science article stimulated a real brouhaha in the psychological sciences. A group of researchers attempted to replicate 100 of the most important published studies in that field. They found that 2/3 of these could not be replicated, thus failing one of science's most fundamental checks. Cancer studies have faced similar problems with non-replicable findings, a worrisome reminder that this replication crisis can have dramatic real-world consequences. Now, for more on the replication crisis and sloppy science more generally, I invite the listener to check out STEM Talk episode 77, where we interview John Ioannidis, and John has absolutely taken a front and center role on addressing this issue with the rest of the science community. Turning now to politics, increasing swaths of science exist where we find people and institutions committed to positions and resistant to evidence. Unfortunately, many people evince the most confidence and the most emotion on topics about which we know the least, and the error bars are the largest. It's become akin to religion in certain parts of science, and this is not good, and it will not go down well with the public.
I have to agree with everything that you said, Ken. So, Ken, another question for you. When it comes to the effect of modern technology on our lives, including our democracy, with your expertise, where do you see this issue headed, and is there a feasible fix that you see?
Wow, another
another heavy question.
Another tough question. At the cultural level, I would characterize myself as hopeful but not optimistic on this topic. We seem positively addicted to convenience, and we value convenience over all else, including privacy and our personal well-being. As we discussed earlier with respect to AI, technology is neutral. It's all about the wisdom with which we use our technology. And on this front, I am concerned. There are lots of ways our future as humans in a technological world could all work out. Some visions of our enhanced futures seem positively wonderful, and others are deeply disturbing. Amplified humans with extended health spans could lead to a new renaissance in a period of material abundance. Or alternatively, we might evolve, and we seem on this path, into a flaccid, perpetually frightened, and easily offended chair-bound species, living each in our own private virtual reality. Or the future may be, and will most likely be, something in between. In the future, we will have options fostered by new science and technology that humans have never had before. The dilemma of human choice will be increasingly central as time goes on. I am all for options, but let's hope we choose wisely. More broadly, as a society, we have a hard time keeping up with the pace of technological development. A good example is the interview we had with Robert Epstein on STEM Talk episode 89, where we discussed his research showing that tech companies such as Google manipulate search results with the apparent goal of affecting elections. Watching our political leaders in congressional hearings as they question tech leaders does not instill confidence that they're able to keep up with technological change or even understand the nature of the business model of some of these companies. So yes, I am concerned.
So Ken, one more question for you. I have heard you interviewed on many topics, including space exploration, nutrition, exercise, and aging, among others, but not much on mental health and wellness. So if you were to identify just a small number of actions aimed at improving a person's mental health, what do you think they would be?
Well, first, advice I give everyone is throw away your TV. Just, you know, and that could actually be fun. You could have some style as you do it, but get rid of that thing. It's essentially a harmful device. And that's a good example of what I was talking about earlier. Technology is neutral. So the technology in the TV is kind of beautiful and neutral. It's what we've chosen to make it that's not beautiful. And when you look at much more powerful technologies like AI, that's where my concern arises. It's not with AI. It's not an AI issue. It's a cultural issue. Second piece of advice would be try to get more sleep. Most people do not sleep enough. And that's harder than it sounds, actually. And I think we're at a time where sleep is finally getting the attention it's long deserved.
Glymphatics.
Glymph, baby.
Sleep and many other things.
Indeed. Exercise. You know, everyone says to exercise, but you're asking about mental health, things you can do to affect mental health. It's well known that exercise does. I think people should spend time in the forest. The Japanese, I think, call it forest bathing or something like that. Apologies to my Japanese friends if I've butchered your term, but I agree with it. It's remarkably good, I think, in terms of our wellness and our feelings of happiness and our feelings of belonging where we are. So spending time in the forest, very valuable. I only have two more suggestions. Try to avoid feeding the zoo humans. So, you know, we're surrounded by zoo humans. Don't let them turn you into a zoo human. So I don't feed the zoo humans. I just observe them. And finally, I think we should all rejoice in the remarkable unlikelihood of our own existence. If you think about it, thousands of your ancestors had to be smart enough and attractive enough to find a mate and procreate and had to be motivated to actually want to do that. And this all had to lead to you. I know it's a just so story, but I like it.
Yeah. I have to say, I always find that fascinating when you start to dig through your personal ancestry and just think about everything that had to happen along the way for all those people to find each other and get together and move and travel and whatever that looks like. And then on the forest piece, we've been having conversations recently. I know there have been a number of studies that have just come out talking about the importance of having children introduced to nature for their overall wellness and for their own growth. So
absolutely.
I think that's for all of us, right? Not just for kids.
So. Yeah, it's for all of us.
So, Ken, this is a question that has come to me a couple of times, and so I'm going to ask it to you because I think you're definitely the person who has an incredible history of self-reinvention, so I want to hear what you have to say about this. This is kind of from listeners to both of us. So you've talked about the importance of self-reinvention over a lifetime. If you never retired and were to reinvent yourself yet again, what would your next professional path look like?
Well, that's kind of hard to know. I like to surprise myself. Maybe I would combine my expertise in computer science with my interests in human performance. I'm particularly interested in how extremely high performers can continue longer at a high level of performance. This applies to all kinds of interesting groups, astronauts, athletes, and elite warfighters, but also to the aging population. But who knows? You know, retirement, you mentioned. I'm not eager to do that. But retirement itself, successful retirement, involves reinvention. I have friends that absolutely have failed retirement.
Yep.
They're more stressed out now than when they were leading large corporations or they were senior executives in the government. They didn't adequately reinvent themselves. But, you know, who knows? I'll likely reinvent myself again once or twice. I hope Nancy likes whatever I invent. It would be bad. I'm done with you, man.
After all this, after all the many reinventions.
Yeah. That last one, I don't like it.
Awesome.
So, Don, you also believe in reinventing oneself and have done so. So here's the same question back at you.
Yeah, I have to say, one, just being here on STEM Talk and getting the chance to chat with these people who just have led incredible lives and have just these fascinating careers. It's definitely been like, oh, I know a number of times I've come out of an interview saying, man, if I had it all to do over again, that's the path I would go. Not that I don't love what I do. I absolutely love every bit of what I've done and what I do now. But people like Natalie Battaglia, who we talked to about looking for exoplanets, I think that's just fascinating.
Yeah, and she's cool.
Margaret Linen, who works with Scripps, she just has an incredible life story. So yeah, any of those fields. I've always kind of had this inkling that I was going to be a scientist from the time I was just a little kid. So I would collect rocks and collect fossils and read all the books and carry them with me. And so I think I was meant to be a scientist, but any different direction of science, I mean, there's just so much out there that fascinates me in this world. And then also physician. I think physicians have an incredibly tough job and are, you know, sometimes underappreciated for the hard work that they do, especially the physicians who are on the cutting edge when it comes to being clinician researchers. Mm. So, but again, I absolutely love what I do now. So, you know, I don't see changing anything along those ways, but all of it's fascinating to me.
Absolutely.
So Ken, a birdie tells me that you have had a new bicycle built for you in Wyoming. So can you tell us about the bike and the kind of riding that you plan to do there?
But that birdie talks a lot. Yes, as some of the listeners know, I very much enjoy cycling. I've always been a road-oriented cyclist, and in Pensacola, I enjoy riding my Rivendell Homer Hilson and also a 1983 Schwinn Paramount race bike. Both are wonderful bikes with steel frames, and the frames in both cases, rather interestingly, many, many years apart, were made by the good folks at Waterford Precision Cycles in Wisconsin. As some of our listeners may know, the Waterford facility now was founded in 1993 by Richard Schwinn and Mark Mueller when they took over Schwinn's Paramount Design Group research and production facility. So the Paramount was built there when it was part of Schwinn, and the Rivendell was built there much more recently when it was operating as Waterford Precision Cycles. Among these two bikes, the Rivendell is much more comfortable and practical around town while still offering good performance. A shout out to Grant Peterson. He's the owner of Rivendell and is a wonderful bicycle designer and the author of two excellent books, the first being Just Ride and the second Eat Bacon, Don't Jog. And they're both very interesting books, and as you can probably tell by the titles, full of humor. But now, Nancy and I are splitting time between Pensacola and an undisclosed location somewhere south of Jackson in Wyoming. And when it's not winter, Jackson is a sort of bicycle nirvana, with incredible bike paths heading pretty much anywhere one wants to go. In our neck of the woods, south of Jackson, though, it's mostly gravel riding. At this point, this is really appealing to me. I'm increasingly sick of people in cars swerving all over the road when texting. So the idea of a place with great bike paths and many miles of gravel sort of beckons to me. And on the new bike you asked about, I've been working with one of the best bike shops in the country, Fitzgerald Cycles in Jackson, and we've built up a very nice custom salsa cutthroat named after the local trout, one of my favorites. It will be unlike all my other bikes in that this bike will be my first bicycle with a carbon frame, hydraulic disc brakes, wireless shifting, and tubeless tires. All my friends think that this old school guy must have lost his mind. but really, I can't wait to spend some time on it.
Yeah, it sounds like a beautiful bike. So, especially riding out there, you can't beat that.
No, it's a great, great, great ride.
Yeah.
Don, for our last question, someone mentioned, perhaps it was the birdie, that you have a past connection with professional hockey, and on the surface, that seems rather improbable. So what is that all about? Tell us about that.
Yeah, and the funny thing is, it still keeps looping back into my current research career, which is even cooler to show you how small the world can be. So when I was transitioning from being a diver full-time into becoming a researcher full-time or going to grad school, I spent 2 years watching children for a professional hockey player. And actually, he was the captain of a professional hockey team at the time. His name is Rod Brindamore. The first year that I was watching the kids for him when he was captain, they won the Stanley Cup. But that's actually the first time that he had won the Cup. So it was very cool to watch somebody truly dedicate themselves to the art of their sport, both, you know, when it comes to their lifestyle and also specifically the training, and then as captain, just from the leadership side of things. So I learned a lot from him just watching him through his actions, and also him as a dad. He's just an incredibly balanced person, which I think is more and more rare these days. Mm. And to transition that, he's actually now head coach for the Carolina Hurricanes, and he just finished his first year of head coaching, and it was really cool to see them make it all the way to the Eastern Conference Finals when they hadn't been to the Stanley Cup playoffs in quite some time. So, and he had a pretty young team, but they kept coming back to, one, the conditioning of his players, because he has incredible interest and passion for optimizing performance in individuals. And he and I actually, as I'm moving forward, realized we have a lot of connections across some of the fields that we're working in on the research side and him on the performance side, which is pretty cool. And then also just the cognitive piece of things, which comes back to belief and how strong that is when it comes to influencing an individual's ability to perform. So that comes up in conversations that we have all the time with the individuals that we work with on the research side for optimizing performance from elite athletics to military. So I think it's pretty cool to have that repeating theme across the course of my life, including being the babysitter for a professional hockey player about 15 years ago. So,
wow.
Yeah.
So we learn new things about you all the time.
Yep. That reinvention of self, right?
Yeah. Cool story.
STEM Talk.
Wow, Ken. So I have to say that I think that was even more fun than our first Ask Me Anything episode.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. And not only do we have fascinating guests on STEM Talk, we apparently have fascinating listeners as well who generate some great questions. So, to all of you who sent us your questions, thank you.
And I agree. Thank you. And if you enjoyed the STEM Talk as much as Ken and I did, we invite you to visit the STEM Talk webpage where you can find the show notes for this and other episodes, stemtalk.us. This is Don Cornegas signing off for now.
And this is Ken Ford saying goodbye until we meet again on STEM Talk.
Thank you for listening to STEM Talk. We want this podcast to be discovered by others. So please take a minute to go to iTunes to rate the podcast and perhaps even write a review. More information about this and other episodes can be found at our website, stemtalk.us. There, you can also find more information about the guests we interview.